can start. Yes, several of you have had sessions already of mine, but Stephen Voltz is my name. I teach at a small liberal arts college in Ohio called Kenyon College, where I teach in the history department, mostly African history. And in teaching African history, admittedly, I teach mostly sub-Saharan Africa. And so for this week, it's in a way, I'm probably more of a student than a teacher, because looking at North Africa, it's a little bit beyond my expertise, but I just found it very fascinating. And what these five sessions are based on, or four sessions are based on, are my experiences last summer. I was able, had the good fortune to be part of a Fulbright seminar for our American college faculty that spent about 6 weeks in Morocco and Tunisia. And the whole theme of the seminar was religious diversity in the Maghreb. Maghreb meaning the West in Arabic, and referring to Western North Africa. So it's like the Western extent of the Muslim world, the Maghreb, which is Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. So we spent all this time just having all these great scholars offering lectures, and performers and artists talking about different aspects of this religious diversity in that region. And it was just very informative for me. I guess among the things, lessons I learned was, and I'm basically looking for your own thoughts and ideas on this, is the extent to which different religious traditions can get along. I think we look at the world today, and I think the common assumption is that religions are, particularly from sort of the mainstream media and sort of perceptions, is that religions are sort of inherently intolerant and leading and promoting violence. You look at whether it's the Holocaust or whether you look at the 9/11 and the sort of recent rise of Islamic fundamentalism. There's an easily reached assumption that religion inspires violence rather than peace and harmony. And so what I find interesting in the case of North Africa, or the Maghreb in particular, was given its position as sort of the western end of the Muslim world, as in other sort of fringe or marginal areas of the Muslim world, in fact, there's been a long history of interaction, mutual interaction between the three monotheistic religious traditions, between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, that all of them are, you could argue, equally part of that society. That even though it's predominantly Muslim today, there's a long history of Christianity in that area, as well as a long history of Judaism. And so what I found interesting, and that was the whole theme of the seminar, was to find evidence of that, to interview Jews, Christians, Muslims, and to find the different ways that those three religions are all part of the heritage and the culture of the Maghreb. And so the broader question for me then raises is, if given this example, perhaps it's wrong for us to assume that religions are sort of prone to intolerance. Perhaps the norm, in fact, is more tolerance and harmony, and that these instances of violence and intolerance are sort of the horrible exceptions to what the longer view of history and the broader view even of the Islamic world. Because you could argue the same thing about the Muslim, so-called Muslim world, that while they do have these extremists, they get all the attention and you ignore the vast majority of Muslims who, in fact, are critical of that use of Islam to promote violence, to promote intolerance of the Western society. And so that's what all these sessions are about. Yesterday I talked about Judaism, the oldest of the three religions in the Maghreb, and today I'm talking about Christianity, the second oldest of the three religions. As I mentioned at the beginning, I shifted the order of these three sessions around because I think it makes a little more sense for a number of reasons, chronologically and otherwise. So looking at Christianity, the question immediately raises, what kind of Christianity? There's very few Christians in the Maghreb today, and what Christians there are, it's strikingly, predominantly from sub-Saharan Africa. During the colonial period, between 1850 and 1950, most Christians were from Europe, from Western Europe, from France, from Italy, from other parts of Europe. And so one could say, it's a church of immigrants, it's an import. And this is, I think, the way Christianity is seen today in the Maghreb. Being predominantly Muslim, those people in the Maghreb who are Christian generally, do not see themselves as sort of natives or indigenous to North Africa. And so I think this influences the way we look at the history of Christianity in the area, as well as the role of Christianity there today. And so that's basically the theme I want to talk about, is what are the intentions that have been a part of this in Africa. Can, given the history of some ancient Christianity in North Africa, can we regard Christianity as a North African religion? Or do we sort of, you know, or is it a European religion? I think we tend to think of it as part of European culture more than other part of other cultures today. So that's what I want to talk about. I don't want to spend that much time, basically, because I want to open up for discussion in this broader question in my mind about how religions get along. I'm curious what everyone else thinks. The other quick part of my introduction is I do this at the beginning of all my lectures, all my classes that I teach, talk about African history. To make the point, you know, when I talk about Africa, I'm talking about a very, very big place. It's not just one place. It's a vast continent with an incredible amount of diversity. To give you a sense of the size, this is a map at the scale of 1 to 10 million, and this is how big Washington State is in relation to Africa. So there's a tendency to think of these African countries as sort of these small, out-of-the-way places. So I don't know the name of all these countries. They're just kind of those obscure, esoteric little places tucked away in a corner of, you know, wherever. But in fact, it's this huge continent with very large countries. About a fourth of the world's countries are in Africa. About a third of the world's languages are African languages. There's a tremendous amount to learn about Africa. That the only time Africa makes the news is when there's some episode of violence or famine, and then suddenly it, you know, kind of leaks in partially into our consciousness. But what gets ignored is the very peaceful places that most of Africa is actually quite peaceful. And there are pockets of prosperity, because poverty is probably truly a problem. But, you know, the tendency to think of Africa as a place in need of our assistance rather than thinking of it as a strong place, a beautiful place with a long history of success at overcoming major obstacles. And so that's what I want to focus on, is the ability of Africans to succeed, not as basket cases. So, I guess before I jump into this, I don't know if anyone has questions or comments or thoughts at the outset. Yeah.
The Christians that are in this part of the country, were they immigrants for economic reasons, or were they religious mission people, or both?
Which ones?
What's ever started Christianity in this region?
Well, it started Christianity in the region was early, Christians from Palestine, from Jerusalem. That's what I'm jumping into. The first Christianity in North Africa, in Tunisia, preceded the spread of Christianity in Western Europe. Most Christians in the world, there was more non-European Christians than there were European Christians up until, for the first 1,000 years of Christianity. Christianity was a predominantly non-European religion. Its birthplace is Jerusalem. It was, obviously first adopted by Jews and then other people living in that area. And it was only gradually that it came to Western Europe. That's kind of the centers of Christianity, early Christianity, among those, Alexandria, Egypt. And then also in what we modern day Tunisia, which was the province of Africa in the Roman Empire. So that's my first point, is that you could argue that for the first 700, 800 years or so of Christianity, once it took root in Tunisia by 100, 200 or so AD, it became the dominant religion. And so it was very much a center of Christian activity and belief. And there's some evidence of this here. This is a baptismal font from a Byzantine church in Tunisia, showing you the ornate mosaics and stuff. Just full of symbols. And I'll talk more about this actually on Friday when I talk about how sort of the pattern of this actually has some sort of ancient connotations or pre-Christian connotations, what the mathematics and the geometry used to build it. Evidence of that. And then here's some grave mosaics in Tunisia. As Christians were buried, there's a sort of a cutoff point between roughly pre-350 and post-350, because prior to the Byzantine Emperor Constantine making Christianity the official religion, obviously there was an era of persecution. So a similar thing happened in Tunisia. There's all kinds of stories of martyrs there, being persecuted and being buried, but this now is kind of after that period, once Christianity was accepted as the mainstream religion of Tunisia. So these are some mosaics that were built over the grave sites of various Christians. sort of celebrating their lives and asking, praying for a peaceful rest and a impending resurrection. Another aspect to this early sort of North African Christianity was the influence of St. Augustine. I mean, St. Augustine, you know, early church father, very influential in sort of figuring out early Christian theology. And some of his writings were actually written in response to a group called the Donatists, or Donatists, I should say, who were centered in what's today Tunisia. And this gets to now what I would argue is a recurring theme in the history of the Maghreb, and that is sort of insiders versus outsiders, or resisting invasion, and trying to claim these world religions as their own. So what had happened in Tunisia, you know, under the years of persecution, you had this sort of very sort of local sort of Christianity emerge, or the local people were real critical of the Roman Empire and sort of equated the Roman Empire with excess and with hedonism and with polytheism. And so now when suddenly the Emperor Constantine says, oh, I'm a Christian too, and now we're going to make this the official religion, well, the initial reaction in Tunisia among these Christians here was they were a little suspicious of this. They thought, well, now all of a sudden, you know, these elites, these wealthy nobles living in the coastal towns and their villas, now are suddenly hopping on this bandwagon and say, yeah, we're Christian too. And they were very suspicious of this, critical of this, thought that for Christians to go along with this would be, in a sense, selling out, to be forsaking the more, I don't know, the way they thought for Christianity to associate with power and wealth was to corrupt the gospel. That, you know, if you look at Jesus preaching, it's always about, you know, sympathizing with the poor and selling everything you have, and this kind of life of simplicity and piety. And so when suddenly all these wealthy nobles and powerful nobles are, you know, becoming Christian, they say no, that's not the true Christianity. And so this movement arises in Tunisia of very much opposed to that, and some of the way it's portrayed is sort of, I guess, faith versus works, that they felt in order to be a good Christian, you have to behave in a certain way, that you can't, that you need to say the right things, do the right things, although, you know, you have to demonstrate your Christianity in certain ways. And so some people, including St. Augustine, take exception with that. They say, well, no, you can associate with the Byzantine rulers and still be a devout Christian, that it's not about what we do, it's about our faith, it's about the grace of God. So it's this early, you know, teachings about that. So I find this, you see this illustrated, you know, if you know the context. This is on the handout I gave you as well, just something from Augustine's one of his more famous books, the Confessions, book 7, chapter 11, where he's basically explaining his own conversion to Christianity. He himself is from the area of Tunisia, a Berber background, sort of non-European background, so African, but then gradually studies Latin and studies Christianity and sort of basically becomes associated with the Byzantine Empire. So here he's talking about the Platonists. He's basically talking about the Greeks, Greek philosophy, which he had studied at a younger age and been intrigued by and fascinated, was sort of a convinced philosophy major as it is. Later on, he said, well, philosophy only gets you so far. It doesn't address the needs of the human heart. So here's talking about that. The books of the Platonists, the philosophers, tell nothing of this. Their pages do not contain the expression of this kind of godliness, this kind of, you know, the emotional aspects of faith. The tears of confession, thy sacrifice, I mean God's sacrifice, a troubled spirit, a broken and contrite heart, the salvation of thy people, the espoused city, the kind of kingdom of heaven, the earnest of the Holy Spirit, the cup of our redemption. In them, the Platonists, no man sings, shall not my soul be subject unto God, for from him comes my salvation. He is my God and my salvation, my defender. I shall no more be moved. In them, no one hears him calling, come unto me, all you who labor. They scorn to learn of him, because he is so-called, you know, meek and lowly of heart, for thou hast hidden those things from the wise and prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes. So in that, he's, in a sense, you know, building off of his philosophical training, and I would argue, in a sense, sympathizing with some of what the Donatists were thinking, in that they're sort of rejecting this urban culture, the Greco-Roman world they feel is corrupting Christianity, But he feels that, okay, to some extent that might be true. I mean, he's critical of Greek philosophy, but at the same time, I think that here he clearly is sympathetic with the Byzantine powers that be. For it is one thing to see the land of peace from a wooded mountaintop and fail to find a way thither, to attempt impassable ways in vain, opposed and waylaid by fugitives and deserters under the captain, the lion and dragon. But it is quite another thing to keep to the highway that leads thither, guarded by the host of the heavenly emperor, on which there are no deserters from the heavenly army to rob the passersby, for they shun it as a torment. I just thought, you can think of this as sort of a metaphorical thing, that this idea that God is the heavenly emperor who protects your passage as you get closer to God. But in the language he uses would have other meanings in the context of Tunisia. And he's clearly, he himself was from, wooded mountaintops, found his way down to the city where he, learned about Christianity, but learned about it, from these learned scholars from, who were very much part of the Roman Empire. So in a sense, he's telling to his fellow Berbers from out in the countryside, if you want to find your way to God, you're going to be, if you don't have the guidance of the heavenly emperor, you're going to be, you're going to have a difficult time, waylaid by fugitives and deserters under their captain. So in a sense, he's, sort of loaded terminology there, critical of these bands of Donatists out in the countryside who are trying to escape rule by the Byzantine government. So it's all this tied with politics and in sort of a historical time context there. Anyway, so this is what Christianity then continues for a while. Byzantine Christianity is well entrenched in what's today Tunisia, Algeria, and a little bit in Morocco. You can find traces of old churches there. But obviously then what happens, and I'm kind of skipping over, is the Arab conquest comes in, and then there's actually similar movements, rebel movements arise where locals reject Arab-style Islam and say, no, that the Berbers have their own sort of expression of Islam that's more authentic, more pious. So you find this theme in the history of the area of sort of Berbers or indigenous peoples, rural-based peoples, who are critical of the coastal elites for corrupting this the pious heart of each of these religions. So same thing happened even before Christianity comes to the scene. So with Christianity, with Islam, there's this recurring pattern. So then Islam takes over, and although Christians remain a significant presence for several hundred years, but what really becomes the turning point is the Crusades, because several European Christian armies come through between 1000 and 1200. And this, basically, the Christian population remains in the Maghreb now is sort of compelled to choose sides, and they're seen as possibly colluding with the enemy, with these Christian invaders from Europe, and so that it becomes much more difficult for Christianity to sustain itself. But it doesn't die off because, one interesting, a story that helps to illustrate this is the case of Sidi Bouzaïd. This is in Tunisia, so there's sort of just north of the capital city of Tunis. There's this really pretty village perched on a hillside overlooking the sea with all these whitewashed buildings and distinctively blue painted doors and window shutters. Very pretty village, but it's named after Sidi. Sidi is like the Arabic word for saint or holy person. And so it was believed that this holy man lived there in this area, and here's his tomb, which is now surrounded by a coffee shop and restaurant. Tourist site, I guess a pilgrimage site. You go for the saint's tomb as well as a good cup of espresso as you're enjoying the Mediterranean sunshine. So the whole village then is named after the saint, Sidi Bouzaïd. So what's the story about Sidi Bouzaïd, the saint? Well, as the story goes, and this is where you get this kind of conflicting views of history, is that King Louis IX, he went on two crusades to liberate Jerusalem from the Saracens, from the Muslims. The first one was pretty unsuccessful. He kind of came back, found his way back to France, where he then proceeded to start universities and was a patron of the arts and is attributed various miracles and works of sort of piety attributed to him. From once later he gets the canonized as Saint Louis. Well, then he went on a second crusade, which was also unsuccessful, and on his way home he actually gets sick and dies in what's today Tunisia. Right at the spot what the ancient ruins of Carthage were located. Well, according to the local residents, before he died, he converted to Islam and then continued to live a saintly life and became Sidi Bou Said. So in the mind of the Tunisians and the Muslims, you know, they also sort of revered and recognized the saintliness of King Louis IX, but in order to sort of, you know, give him, you know, for in order for him to be a true saint, he had to embrace the beliefs of Islam. And so that's what they believed happened. Well, the, as you can imagine, the French don't agree to that same story. And as the story goes, I mean, basically his body was, you know, cut into pieces. Part of it was buried in, you know, I think his heart was, I can't remember which parts were buried where, but most of it, I think, was buried in Tunisia, but parts of it were carried back to Paris, where then it was, you know, buried in a cathedral in France. Well, what happens is after the French colonized Tunisia, they're going to recapture their narrative and promote their own understanding of the story of St. Louis. So within sight of Sidi Bou Said's tomb, they build this cathedral in memory of St. Louis. So there's a St. Louis church at Carthage, built, I think, during the 1920s or so. So this big church with statues and memorials to St. Louis. So that's what form Christianity takes then in Tunisia, is during this long period of sort of Muslim reign, it is sort of absorbed. I mean, literally, you know, these Christian holy people absorbed into Islam, which then changes then with under the colonial period. You also have other Christians that end up in the area. There's various, as sort of these, you know, any group that is accused of heresy during the various religious controversies in Europe, there's groups that take refuge in Tunisia and North Africa, in Morocco and in Algeria. So there's various waves. And so you have a steady, steady kind of waves of Greek, Spanish, and Italian merchants and fishermen who come and settle down and have their own chapels and so forth. Later in the early 19th century, Maltese come, you know, from Malta, and they establish little neighborhoods, Christian neighborhoods, amidst the Muslim majority. Captives by pirates. I mean, that's an interesting story here. I mean, they got a lot of attention in Europe during the 18th century, you know, 1700s, because you had pirates going out from these coastal fort towns in Morocco, Algeria in particular, and intercepting European ships, and then they take the people captive and then hold them for ransom. At one point, kind of notoriously, I don't know if people are aware of this, in fact, some of those raiders went as far north as Ireland. And like Vikings of old, this was in the 1700s, they went and they attacked an Irish village, took everyone prisoner, brought them all the way back to Morocco, and held them prisoner there. And so some of them were sold into slavery and so forth. So this was an interesting phenomenon of how Christians ended up in Morocco. Finally, you know, the United States got tired of this and invaded in early 1800s, with our first foreign war. So that's another, I guess, element of Christians in Morocco and in the Maghreb. And then finally, French colonialism. But first, I'm going to... the way the Christians ended up, was in that same spot within eyesight of Sidi Bou Said and the St. Louis Cathedral is the old World War II cemetery. Thousands of Americans, that this was kind of moving to visit this. I kind of underestimated, the effect it would have is... Because on each one of these headstones, if you've ever been to Normandy and France, I mean, there's an even much larger cemetery at Omaha Beach of just the tens of thousands of Americans who ended up there. And on each of these crosses is the name and rank and hometown of these people, and just all the different people from all over the U.S. who ended up. What happened was, during World War II, when they were driving the Germans out of North Africa, it also was the site for air bases. And so a lot of the killed and wounded were... on flights, bombing runs over to Romania or to Italy, or during the invasion, the failed invasion, well, difficult invasion of Sicily. There was all kinds of casualties, including a troop ship that was attacked and sunk accidentally by American bombers. So, they had, like, on the wall back here, more than 2,000 names of missing in action whose bodies were never recovered. So another aspect of Christianity and so then you have the colonial period, and so the French come in, mid-1800s, and sort of reestablish a Christian presence there. But it's, again, it's a church of immigrants. It's primarily intended for European settlers, but there's quite a few French and Italians then who settle in North Africa, in the Maghreb, And so they build various churches. The Cathedral of St. Vincent de Paul in Tunis, the outside and the inside. It's interesting still, they try to adopt some sort of Middle Eastern style, sort of a mix of architecture styles. I'm just going to keep on going here. But what then happens is once these countries get their independence, I mean, Christianity during the colonial period is seen as the religion of the colonizer. And so there is very little, if any, conversion of locals to Christianity during that time period. And in sort of reaction to this, when they get their independence, one thing that Tunisia did, I was kind of struck by this, is they basically closed all the Catholic churches except for 12. They said, all right, we'll let you guys, you Christians, keep 12 of your churches. So like the St. Louis church I just showed you in Carthage, that was actually just turned into a museum. They took down the crosses and just kind of made it into this museum. Here, this French Catholic Church in Tunisia was made out of municipal office buildings. There's no evidence that, you know, anymore that it was had been a church at one point. So, you know, now they just, you know, install windows or you go to pay your water bill or whatever. And so, right, so clearly there's a tension to this, a reaction to this. But on the other hand, I mean, the vast majority, well, not the vast, quite a few of those Christians left anyways. And as these countries got their independence, there was a sense on the part of the settlers that they were no longer welcome there. But clearly, you know, they've been driven out. And so the local population had taken control of the government, the economy, and the churches. So what happens, what's going on today? What's the state of Christianity today? It kind of has this, you know, at its height during the Byzantine era, and then sort of recedes gradually under Arab rule and Berber rule. Has a little bit of resurgence, if you will, during the colonial period, and then kind of retreats again in post-independence. Well, this is, you know, the state of it today. What I found striking is you visit these old, big old Catholic churches in Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia today, and who's filling the pews? There might be a few, you know, old French women who are kind of, you know, remnants of the colonial period, but most of the people living in the pews now are actually from sub-Saharan Africa. From Ivory Coast, from the Catholic churches are from predominantly Catholic countries down south. From Ivory Coast, from Congo, from Guinea-Bissau, from various Niger, Mali, and places. Well, Niger, Mali are mostly Muslim, but mostly even further south than that. And it's really fascinating to see now. I mean, in this particular church service I went to, actually the priest was French, but then he. The liturgy itself was in a mixture of French. He preached in French, but then some of the songs were sort of an assortment of different languages from different parts of Africa. You know, I even asked the choir director, say, what song was that? You know, what language is that? And she said, oh, I'm not sure. And they're kind of taking these different, because she herself was fluent in maybe two or three African languages, but was from a part of West Africa, you know, had no knowledge of Lingala, which is in the Congo, and so on. So you just have this incredibly multi-ethnic congregations. You know, represented in the room are probably 20 or 30 different African languages, and yet here they are, united under this, you know, one roof, this Catholic church, worshiping together, because that's one, you know, part of their culture that they have in common. So one is the Catholic faith or Christianity, because there's also Protestant churches run by Nigerians. But so the Catholic churches are run by primarily, and then another church I went to, the St. Francis Church in Fez in Morocco. But the priest was, in fact, from sub-Saharan Africa. And the other, I suppose, utilitarian purpose of these churches, or them becoming members, as happens anywhere in the world when you have immigration, is the churches serve as not just a way to retain your cultural identity, but it also serves as a support network. On the bulletin board right behind where I took this picture, they had a printout of anyone who wanted to could add their name to this list, or you give your name, your cell phone number, your email address, what country you're from, what you're interested in. So basically, so all these people, well, you can read the, I can't quite read the names of the countries, but these are all names of different countries in Africa. So they're all organized, this is just focusing, I could have spread it out. So it's all these different countries, all they're represented in. So even if people aren't attending church regularly, they want to get their name on the board, and so the idea is then if they can, you know, find other people from the same country, help each other out, offer, you know, space in their apartment, offer leads in getting jobs. And so these sub-Saharan African immigrants are primarily economic refugees, if you will, seeking a better life Ideally, they're trying to get all the way to Europe, but it's more and more difficult to do that. I mean, it's made it to the news in the U.S., but, you know, boatloads of refugees trying to get from Morocco to Spain and getting intercepted or sunk, or trying to get to Sicily from Tunisia. And so more and more, they're just settling down in the Maghreb and North Africa, just making that their new home. I met some individuals who had now been in Morocco for 7-8 years, and basically were, you know, learning Arabic and learning their kind of way around kind of the authorities, if you will, in these countries. So now Christianity, if you want to describe the state of Christianity in the Maghreb today, it's predominantly sub-Saharan Africans, which sort of adds another element to this, that you get sort of race tensions. There's a sense, you know, among the Arab or Berber Muslim majority that, you know, Christianity remains the religion of outsiders. Not just that it's a different religion, but also it's the religion of people coming to take our jobs from us, kind of thing. So there's a certain animosity and mistrust there. How this has surfaced in Tunisia most recently now is, you know, with the Arab revolutions, the Arab Spring of last year. And so this has created more tensions, new tensions, if you will. In Tunisia, the state of Tunisia, I mean, it's very primarily a secular country, if you will, has developed a long history of tolerance for different religions. Sort of Western in its culture, very kind of westernized. This just shows you a typical seascape in monastery. It's highly touristed. Tourism is the number one industry in the country. You have millions of tourists now, primarily from Eastern Europe, come and fill these huge tourist hotels with the buffets and everything. A lot of them, from Eastern Europe. So it's sort of an inexpensive place to come. Kind of like, I suppose, Cancun, perhaps, or Miami Beach, or sort of think of Branson, Missouri, crossed with Miami Beach. I don't know. Very tacky, most of it. Anyway, but so what you have here, so you have all this wealth and sort of westernization concentrated along the coast. You actually have zones called tourist zones, zone de touristique, where there's sort of different laws about where alcohol flows, where, women are walking around in bikinis and basically flaunting what people further inland feel is proper behavior. And so there is that tension in Tunisia. So what's happened now, as you perhaps might imagine, in this sort of revolution, they overthrew this kind of secular dictator, and then what took the place of that power vacuum has still not been decided. Because they had elections in October to form the Constituent Assembly to kind of write a new constitution, and the Ennahda party took 40% of the vote, so it's not a majority, but they got more votes than anybody else. And Ennahda means renaissance, but it was the explicitly Islamist party, and so why would they get the most support if this secular country? Because the Islamist party basically feels that the Donatists, they feel that that the powers that be, the elites of the country, have become corrupted, and so they feel that the proper behavior is more important. I guess the Islamists are trusted more by the general population, but especially in the rural areas in the interior, trusted more to use the country's wealth wisely. That they're not just going to put stuff in their pockets, they're not just going to buy yachts and hang out on the beaches, that they're going to use it for the benefit of the people. If they adhere to Islamic principles of charity, they feel that the Islamists can be trusted better. And so that's one reason why they got more votes than anybody else. Well, I saw saw a little personal encounter with this when our group, we went to the mosque at Kairouan, which is it's the oldest mosque in North Africa, one of the oldest mosques in North Africa. So there's this really sacred spot built in the 600s. And what happened is these young men, the Salafists basically is the term for trying to return, like fundamentalists, trying to return to the original Islam. So the idea is to dress like Muhammad, they imagine Muhammad might have dressed, or to wear a beard and so on. So they had seized possession of this mosque. And this is after the revolution, so there's no sort of police or, park police or whatever to stop them. And so they just kind of asserted themselves and said, we want this to be once again a sacred space, primarily a sacred space and only secondarily a tourist spot. But prior to that, it was overrun with tourists. And so we kind of mean, they weren't violent or angry. I mean, they weren't armed or anything. But still, it was, you know, this interesting, you know, encounter here to kind of see what's happening. This is our translator. He's a grad student at University of Michigan. He's himself is in Connecticut or something, but he's fluent in Arabic. And so basically we relied on him to explain to them what we were doing there. And so it's interesting. The conversation that's happening here is basically this young man here couldn't understand how he could be fluent in Arabic and be fully conversant with the Quran and not be a Muslim. So he was like, how can you? And it's basically very earnest, you know, but very much they had never left their own village and just saw the world from, I would say, a very narrow straw. So anyway, so it was a very interesting conversation. There. But so that's, you know, so they're, no, they're not critical, they're not, they would not argue about, for expelling Christians, but they do feel that Islam is the sort of religion that's, of Tunisian culture, that Tunisian society should embrace Islam. And here was another little instance of this tension. We visited one Catholic church in one town in Tunisia where some sort of angry young men had thrown a firebomb at the door, you know, trying to burn down the door and the gate entrance. So then the interim government had intervened and helped them put up a security stuff, an alarm system. At the same time, some other sort of college students who are very embarrassed by the activities of the Salafi young men, scrawled across the street, you know, in spray paint here, you know, "We respect you, we love you, you are one of us," you know, signed the new generation, basically to the Christian, you know, congregants. They're basically saying, don't take this as an indication of what, you know, the dominant feeling in Tunisia is, that we Muslims, we embrace you as fellow, and, you know, fully equal members of Tunisian society. Christians. And so you have this. This is an unresolved tension still today in Tunisia about what is Tunisia's future? Is it a multicultural, you know, religiously, you know, pluralistic society, or should it be more explicitly Muslim and promoting Muslim teachings, Islamic teachings? Right, and so this similar tension has emerged now in Morocco, and this made the news about a year and a half ago. Most of the American evangelical Protestant missionaries were expelled from Morocco for proselytizing. It's against the law still in Morocco to proselytize, for Christians to proselytize. They can be Christian, they can worship, but they can't seek to convert Muslims to Christianity. And so there was some American evangelicals who were running some schools and other institutions, and they were kicked out for breaking the law. And so, you know, I think the Moroccan government did that not because they were themselves opposed to Christianity, but more it was to placate the Islamist sort of voices in opposition within Morocco. And they're trying to keep them happy. And so that's kind of what I have to say. And then the way this serves as a preview for tonight's film of Gods and Men is the film portrays a similar kind of tension became very violent during the 1990s in Algeria. What happened in Algeria, in essence, they went through this Arab Spring a little bit earlier. There they allowed a democratic election. What happened is there, as one might expect, the Islamist party got the most votes, as it has in Tunisia now and is about to get in Egypt. It has in Turkey as well. And so, but the response there was rather than accepting the results of the election, they just nullified them. The kind of military secular government nullified the result of the election. And so then the Islamists got very angry with that. Thought, what you promised us democracy, and now you're saying you want democracy only if people elect you back in power. And so then they took off to the hills and with weapons, and then proceeded to fight an increasingly violent guerrilla war against the Algerian government. So what happens with this group of French monks, and it's a true story, they were sort of up in this village where there had been a monastery for at least 150 years and had become integral members of the society of this community up in the Atlas Mountains. And so then they were torn by this. That at the one hand, they were devoted to continuing to serve the Berber population up in the mountains. At the other hand, on the other side, the Islamists are sort of saying, what are you guys doing here? And not only, you know, are you guys on the side of the government or in the side of us, they're kind of forced to choose sides and yet at the same time retain their sort of Christian nonviolent stance, and so the film portrays that. It's a dramatic film, but based on actual events. So I don't know. Questions? Discussion at this point? Yeah.
Does Islam have a tendency to try to spread its religion the same as Christianity does, where they send out missionaries? I don't see that.
No, they don't. I mean, it's very organized very differently. I mean, first, they don't have this kind of church hierarchy the way kind of institutionalized Christianity does, and so there isn't a sense that they need to build up the size of these institutions. You know, I think Christianity often has this competition between different denominations trying to get the largest flocks, as it were. You don't have a similar phenomenon in Islam. What you do have in terms of proselytizing is more like Saudi Arabia, for example. There's a strong proponent of this more conservative Islam or more fundamentalist Islam. So what they'll do is they'll give money to start up these schools that teach children this stricter version of Islam, or they'll promote, you know, not just schools, but you know, they'll offer scholarships for people to come and study in these universities in Saudi Arabia. So there's some of that, but it's not so much at trying to convince non-Muslims to become Muslim as it is trying to convince Muslims to adopt the teachings and practices of the fundamentalists in Saudi Arabia.
I was in Pakistan in 1989 at the end of the Russian War.
Right.
I was in Pakistan. We were dealing medically with refugees from Afghanistan. And it seemed like there was a big presence of Saudi Arabia in Pakistan, and they were running most of the hospitals to do the same thing. We were doing the smaller stuff.
Right. Yeah. So what were you doing in Pakistan?
Well, I've been orthopedics, and so we were part of a thing called Orthopedics Overseas, where you go into a country and they actually set up residency programs to teach them to make their own doctors in the country, and then not actually do the work, but try to teach the work.
So that
was as an assistant was doing the work.
Okay, yeah.
So a bomb blast was primarily people that were getting blown up by landmines.
Yeah.
From the Russians.
Right, you know, prosthetics and all that. So was it your sense that the Saudi Arabian hospitals, did people see them as having sort of a hidden agenda, or were they seeing sort of legitimate charity?
They were good. I think the one thing that I noticed when we traveled up north in Pakistan up to the Kalash country was there's an element of people there that are not Muslims at all. They're Buddhist. Mm. And the government, which was Muslim, was trying to get rid of that religion by the school, by taking the kids and putting them into
the It's like the Taliban, I guess, and blowing up those huge Buddhist statues.
Yeah. So that was a culture that was different. You could see from, we weren't involved in that.
Right. Yeah, but yeah, I'm guessing is there any sort of visible Christian presence in Pakistan? Or?
I didn't see it.
Okay, yeah.
But I wasn't there as part of the church.
Right. Yeah. Any other thoughts, comments, questions?
So you say that there's not the same religious organization in Islam. Christianity, do you think that has something to do with why in all these countries they're having these Arab Springs, there's more of a political presence of these, because what they lack in kind of a organized religion structure they make up for politically within these nations?
That's interesting. Yeah, whether sort of Islam expresses itself in government rather than in sort of controlling parts of society and like as an institution. That's interesting. I don't know. I mean, because there are some ways that, you know, sort of Muslim societies, as it were, I mean, do have sort of local control or I mean, there's people who are respected, like sheikhs or you know, scholars or imams, you could argue, have some power locally so that they wouldn't need to do that at a national level. Yeah, I'm not sure what you say about that. I mean, some of it, I would say, goes back to the origins of Islam. I mean, Muhammad himself, what he was preaching, you know, was creating Islamic government. I mean, basically, he wasn't interested in converting Muslims so much as he was creating Islamic governments. I mean, I mentioned this yesterday. I mean, like, for example, in Egypt, the majority of the people remained Christian for the first three centuries of Muslim rule. There was no sort of pressure or expectation that they would convert to Islam, and that was sort of a secondary interest. So I think the focus was on creating sort of more sort of God-pleasing government, God-pleasing a social structure, taxation system, and sort of a top-down sort of Islam. Because they also had taxation for non-Muslims, so it's like, you know, the more people convert, the less money the government's going to have. And there was a realization that this Christian population in North Africa, you know, was many of them were merchants, and so was the Jewish population, so they didn't want to disrupt that economy.
Yeah.
They'd rather say, okay, just, you know, let us be the army, let us control the government, you guys keep doing your thing.
Yeah. Is there much Jewish presence left?
There's some. I mean, like I mentioned yesterday, I mean, Morocco, the numbers are, went from, in 1950, there was about 250,000 Jews in Morocco, and then by today now it's less than 6,000. And a lot of that has to do with Palestinian-Israeli politics and sort of Arab, you know, opposition to Israel. So Morocco joined other Arab countries in solidarity basically against Israel, and of course the Jews within Morocco felt, you know, jeopardized by that, alienated. Yeah, so I would argue that that's more of a modern phenomenon. That Jews generally were welcome and were integral members of the North African society until after 1950. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know about that. Christianity. Well, I mean, I'm curious. Well, that's my sort of recurring question with all this. I mean, are our religions, you know, inherently intolerant and exclusive, or is there hope for sort of religious tolerance? Is religious tolerance the exception or the norm?
I don't know the answer to that question, but obviously, I think bringing the information you brought from Tunisia, these examples right there, you had kind of both sides, but it seems like it depends on what pressures are present, just like in our country, what he has the most clout and can, you know, really dictate the country's position. But then within the country, there's so much diversity.
Right.
But yeah. It seems like from what I've heard, even in Iraq, that there was a large Christian presence.
Oh, yeah.
That when we came in, it stirred up trouble for the Christians.
Right. Suddenly they're seen as collaborators just by virtue of Christianity.
Yeah, and a lot of them have been exiled, but they've come to the United States for refuge.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard. So it seems like there's just a lot of meddling over history that have influenced the peace or the
Yeah, so there's not the religious teachings necessarily that, you know, are the cause of tension as much as it is the political association.
Right, whether it's somebody coming to colonize or whatever.
Right. Yeah. I don't know, thoughts. Yeah.
I read something very recently, just something I read here, about Christians being really under attack. And I know they were in Iraq. You know, I forget what they're called, the Assadi or something, Christians who had been there for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
And they basically had to escape, most of them. Mm-hmm. But apparently, that's happening in a lot of different countries, and I think most of them are Islamic. I mean, I don't want to perpetuate that view, but I'm just curious about why and how that's happening, because it's from the people I've talked to are all really see Islam as a peaceful, peaceful religion, and they don't seem to have the missionary spirit that we have, or that some Christian sects, Christian seems to lend itself to being sometimes we're the only way, and you need to be converted,
and Great Commission, How do you reconcile that?
I think the colonial period, I think it was a big factor, and suddenly now Christianity became associated with sort of European powers coming in and taking over Muslim countries. So then there's a sense that to fight against colonialism is also to fight against Christianity, and this association of Christianity with external or foreign influence. I guess. Go ahead.
This is more of a question
plenty, I mean, I guess with the Maghreb or, you know, Western North Africa offers and find other places, and I'll talk more about this on Friday, is Sufism. It's just kind of a mystical version of Islam, and many people would see hope in that. I mean, if the mystics, if you will, of who are Muslim, and the mystics of Christianity and Judaism all kind of get together, they find they have a lot in common. Mysticism means more focusing more on the of God as an experience, like you're trying to experience God or sort of an emotional encounter, and less about the doctrine, less about institutional divisions. And so there's a sense that, well, if we can find, we're more likely to find common ground within sort of this kind of mystical understandings of each of the religions, and you find that the language that's used about God being love, I mean, you know, there's Arabic Sufi poets who talk about God is love, and it's like all these, you know, within Judaism as well, and Kabbalah and stuff. There's this. So some people talk about, okay, maybe there's grounds there for fruitful dialogue, but how far it can go, I don't know, or whether it could have any influence on government policy, I think it's probably more questionable. Yeah.
It seems like, as far as religious strife, often seems like it's a mask that's used for other more political intentions, economic intentions. I'll bring up one very un-African example, Northern Ireland, where it's this battle of you know, it's supposed to look like Protestant versus Catholic, Jameson versus Bushmills. But it's politically it's about Britain versus the Republic of Ireland, and freedom, but they use Protestantism and Catholicism to, I don't know, maybe make it feel like it is more of a righteous cause than just economic government. It seems like that's some of the theme, where it's to maybe make people feel like they don't have a choice.
Yeah, so this conviction that God is on our side, and it kind of gives one side the moral high ground, or
exactly,
serves as justification for more atrocities. I don't know the answer. I mean, so I guess encourage you to come to the movie tonight, because this is where this group of monks wrestles with this question about what are they called to do. I mean, I sense this kind of impending martyrdom. Are they foolish to kind of stick around in the midst of the civil war? And how do they continue to be Christian without sort of alienating themselves from the Muslim majority? And so I guess where I find hope in the film, as well as in the history of Maghreb, is in the film, as you'll see, I mean, there's this discussions between the monks and the local population, who are all Muslim, but who see the Christian monks as integral members of the society. They don't see that the two religions are irreconcilable. They see them as, you know, woven together in part of the fabric of, in this case, Algerian society. So that's the thing, I guess, to try and find some larger umbrella which can encompass both religions and keep them united, whether it's the nation of Algeria, Morocco, or Tunisia, or whether it's a reconceived image of God as being encompassing all religions, or looking at if you want to include the three monotheistic religions, they're all the religions of Abraham, if you will, and just kind of focus on the areas of oil. I mean, Mary, for example, people point out that Mary is mentioned, the mother of Jesus is mentioned more times in the Quran than she is in the Bible. Muslims feel that they are sort of the third and last sort of and perfect expression of this monotheistic Middle Eastern religious tradition that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are all kind of lumped together. And even people, I've talked to people, from China or from, other traditions, and they would say, if you're all reading the same Bible, as it were, or, all believe the same creation story, and, look at the prophets and have the same understanding of God, to a certain extent, what are you guys fighting each other for? And so it's interesting how you can expand that bigger and bigger. You know, Lutherans might say, why are Lutherans fighting against each other? And then
yeah.
Christians might say, why are Christians? And you can, I think you can take even a step bigger to between Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. There's a lot of, I would argue, you know, common ground that tends to be ignored. Yeah. All right, well, thanks for your attention.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, that's true.
And we'd like to say the only news we ever get is when something
bad happened, right?
Tragic,
right.
Or whatever. And, it just seems so hopeless in so many ways.
Right.
I think we're hearing more now with the whole advent of the Arab Spring.
Oh, yeah.
A lot more now. But
oh, yeah.
That's only the tip of the what hit, right?
Mm-hmm. I don't understand what it is describing these kind of differences. And, I mean, you can see each group feeling more comfortable if they're the only group in that area. And that's part of the
right.
Nature thing. If everyone in this village is all of the same background
mm-hmm.
and belief and view of life, it makes life pretty simple.
But hey, Tom, it is ignorance, too. I mean, like this,
sure.
These young men in this mosque, none of them had ever, you know, read a Western book. You know, they just were completely, their only perception of America was, you know, of drones bombing people and women and children being killed by American-made weapons.
Well, we here in America today have two political parties that don't believe anything they hear from someone on the other party.
Right,
they
true,
only believe
yeah.
what they want to believe.
Right,
from
right,
the source
right.
they trust. And so we don't have, we're becoming kind of a great divide politically
yeah,
in
right.
the country right now. It's so scary.
Yeah, yeah.
Today, or don't believe in the word of it.
Right. Rather stick to the, you know, the stereotype of the other person than actually
yeah,
sit down
I mean,
and talk about
you
it.
Know, the Obama presidency, I'm an Obama supporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up in a household that was Republican. And in the last
mm-hmm.
20 years, I just got more. I couldn't stand that.
Right.
That party line so incompatible with the older message that is for
right.
people and to be look out for the poor and help the sick and the.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republican Party, which I used to really believe hook, line, and sinker,
mm-hmm.
and really feel like these guys are lazy. I don't know if they wanted to get a job, they could get one. But, you know, I'm becoming, that's not true anymore. We've got to have welfare to help people that
weren't
born on the same side of the town as I was.
I think it's just like a disagreement on how it's supposed to be done. I think it's like two wings of the same bird, because it's the same, it's just different ways of going about it. Values,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you think about it, but just disagreements about how the effectiveness of maybe their methods.
We're challenged in how we interact and relate with the rest of humanity.
But I think it's becoming
mm-hmm.
more divergent as time goes on. The political parties, like I think
yeah.
we're so divergent on the tone of the party lines
well,
because those
right,
are extreme.
Right.
Yeah, but the tone,
you know,
the tone is just a
tap
on it, and it's always
yeah.
pointing the finger.
Yeah, that's one of the things I'll bring up to people. I'm an Obama supporter as well. But like the whole thing about sort of caricaturing this healthcare reform as Obamacare just ignores the history. I mean, basically, you know, Obama initially wanted something like Hillary Clinton's model, you know, like single payer or, you know, like Canadian system. But then he basically made a compromise, and so-called Obamacare is virtually identical to what the Republicans themselves were advocating during the 1990s in response to Hillary's, you know, promotion. They said, all right, fine. Yeah, exactly. And so, it's all because it's so, regardless of the actual pieces of it, which is exactly what the Republicans were demanding in the 1990s, now they're suddenly saying, oh, but it's by Obama, it must be bad or socialist or whatever.
It seems like it's hard to be a pure, you know, politician when, you know, they might be just really great individuals and then they're just corrupted by a system where they
have
to.
Yeah,
it's,
system.
Yeah, it's,
their,
it's hard to trust
yeah,
anything.
Yeah,
but
I might be a supporter of.
Right, like the healthcare reform. I don't know what the estimates are. Like $700 million. You know, so what the healthcare companies spent on lobbying Congress as the bill was being written.
The money that's spent on just campaigning in general.
it's getting scary.
Yeah.
$30 million. In Wisconsin, they spent $30 million.
Oh, right, yeah.
Defense budget right now alone isn't even included in the budget sometimes. I mean, you know.